The Mac Observers, Mac Geek Gab, episode number 632 for Sunday, November 20th, 2016. Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observers, Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in your questions, tips, and cool stuff found. We share your questions, tips, and cool stuff found. We've got a little bit of each of that today here because the goal is for all of us to learn at least four new things each and every time we get together. Sponsors for this episode include Otherworld Computing at MacSales.com with their Thunderbolt 3 dock that we mentioned during the content portion of the show last week, Barebones Software with BB Edit, as longtime listeners will know, and VideoBlocks at videoblocks.com/MGG, where you can get a one-year subscription for just $149. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
How is it today, John F. Braun? How are you?
It's kind of hazardous, man.
Really? What are you hazarding? Hazard a guess?
Oh, we got a hazardous weather outlook.
Really? That's kind of weird. Apparently,
the winds are going to kick up a bit today.
All right.
Tomorrow.
Well. They
blow things over, and hopefully we'll make it through the episode here, and I won't lose power.
Stay safe. Yeah. That's always a drag. We've had that. I know that scenario. Hey, let's dive right in, because we've got a lot to go through today. Next week, we will be doing our router deep dive. And we've got you folks have been great sending in questions. We're really going to focus on wireless routers and the wireless portion and why all the new technology matters. A big focus of it will be mesh stuff, but we'll talk about extenders and sort of the whole picture of that. But yeah, send in your stuff. Feedback at MacGeekGab.com is the right place to send in those questions. And we'll be prepping that show probably early in the week because it's Thanksgiving here in the U.S. So make sure you get those questions in. Right, John?
Right.
Okay. Going to Bruce. Bruce asks, he says, previous to Sierra, you could display a virtual on-screen keyboard through System Preferences keyboard, with which you could do certain things like press a key which isn't working on your real-world keyboard. As far as I can see, this is no longer available in Sierra. Has this moved to some other obscure place, or has this functionality simply disappeared? And it actually is still there. You just kind of go about it a different way. If you go to System Preferences keyboard, right where you were looking, and then go to Show Keyboard, check the box that says Show Keyboard and Emoji Viewers in the menu bar. Then you get a new little keyboard menu up in the, and this is actually true in both Sierra and El Capitan. I think the change happened just before El Capitan. You get a new little keyboard menu up in your menu bar, and you can choose to show keyboard viewer or show emoji and symbols, and either one of those will appear on your screen and you can see. And it's kind of weird because as you're typing, you get to see which keys are being pressed and all that good stuff. So that's where it lives now and for the foreseeable future. So
it actually lives in more than one place.
Because
I
just
started looking at this.
Yeah.
If you click on input sources.
Yes.
There's a show input menu bar that seems to put something very similar up there.
So yeah, that allows you to pick different keyboards. You can have your US keyboard, or you could have a katakana keyboard, whatever it is that you want. That's not going to show you the keyboard though when you choose it. It's related, right? But different. Or am I misinterpreting what you're suggesting here, Mr. Braun?
No, you're right. Yeah, it's a different way of getting there, I think.
Well, I don't think it's going to show you the keyboard on screen, but maybe it does. I don't seem to, even though I have the show input menu. Oh, that's interesting. It is the same. Huh. You're right. So even though the checkbox does the same thing despite two different labels, at least for me on El Capitan, because I'm still on El Capitan here in the studio, because of Tascam and their drivers and all that stuff. That's really bizarre. So I guess if I had multiple keyboards here, would it, Okay. So here's the thing. If you only have one keyboard selected in the input sources menu, that checkbox, displays what I would call the keyboard slash emoji menu. However, if you have more than one keyboard in your input sources, that checkbox changes and the icon for that checkbox matches the keyboard that you have selected. So for me right now, it's an American flag because I have the US keyboard selected. And then below that, you get these other options that we talked about: show keyboard viewer, show emojis and symbols. And then you can get back to either input sources or keyboard preferences from that menu as well. So it is but one menu for the keyboard, even though it's named different things, and different things will happen depending on what options you have chosen elsewhere. So that's pretty interesting.
And on my Sierra machine, there's an additional dictation tab under keyboard.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense. Yep.
Or I don't see one on my Mini here, though I may not see it because, well, no, shouldn't I? No.
So I here's another way to show the emoji viewer. If you are in a text field and then press Command and Control keys on your keyboard. Oh, maybe not. That's supposed to do it. Oh, that's
You're so close.
Okay, what am I missing, John? I know there's one. I hadn't prepped this.
Control, I forget this one too. Control, Command, Space.
Oh, it's Control, Command, Space. Okay.
Brings up the emoji viewer.
Is that right? No. For me, it's bringing up a spotlight thing on this machine.
Okay, on both my machines, if I hold down Control, but Command, Space.
Oh, I'm using Control, Option. Sorry, John. Yeah, you're totally right. Control, Command, Space. Yeah, that's right. Nice. Cool. Thank you, Bruce.
Wow. We just learned four things.
There's our four things. There. Thanks, folks. We'll see you next week. That's right. All right. Giles has an interesting question. He asks, I was heartened to hear Dave put the new Mac purchasing into the family setting in Mac Geekab 629. Getting myself sorted is always the least of my worries. It's what happens further downstream when the chain of older Macs all moving onto different homes invariably causes problems. At the end of my current line is a late 2008 unibody MacBook that, as far as I can tell, will go as far as OS 10.11 El Capitan, but not Sierra. It's seen a few hardware upgrades in its time and has an SSD and its full complement of 8 gigs of RAM. The first question is, with the specs above, would you recommend going all the way to El Capitan, or is there an accepted best OS for older machines like this? My second question is about practicalities. Of course, I'll clone their drive and update all their software in advance, but having done a fresh install of my chosen OS, I intend on doing a quick and dirty restore from their latest Time Machine backup. If I'm going all the way back to 10.11, should I update the OS to El Capitan on their old machine first, or will Migration Assistant handle the fact that I'm trying to restore onto a different version of the OS? So the quick answer is Time Machine's usually pretty good about taking stuff from an older OS like you're talking about and bringing it forward. Generally not as good at the opposite of bringing newer stuff back. Although I've seen that work in limited cases. So I think you're going to be fine with the Time Machine or the Migration Assistant portion of this. When considering an older OS, for this machine with 8 gigs of RAM, I think El Capitan's going to be okay. It's hard to say though. Thoughts on how much RAM do you have in your, and we're talking about a MacBook, not a MacBook Pro here, John, but you have a 2012 MacBook, right? And that's MacBook Pro. Right. And that's running Sierra just fine for you, right?
Yes. And I put, and it's a 4-core, and I put 16 in it because I can. I don't know if I can put in more, but 16 is.
No, I think that's the limit. Yeah.
It's fine for what I use it for. Yeah. And my Mini, which I haven't upgraded yet, it's still on El Capitan, that has 8, and that also runs just fine.
How many cores?
That's only 2.
Interesting. Okay, so, all right, so this helps put all this in perspective, because the machines that I have that are dual core machines with 4 or 6 gigs of RAM seem to have real trouble with El Capitan and Sierra. But that 8 gig of RAM number seems to be kind of the magic thing right now. So, you know, I feel like, I mean, here's the thing, Giles, I realize you don't want to spend every waking hour migrating OSs around, but it's not like you're making a decision that is irreversible the moment you make it. If the intended user has problems with this machine with El Capitan, you can always downgrade it. You'll have to deal with a little bit of migration stuff manually, as we just mentioned, but I think you'll be okay. I would say El Capitan on this one. Thoughts, John? You got a vote?
El Capitan.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't think you ever want to go more than 3 releases back, because I think my observation, I don't know if it's documented anywhere, but they tend to stop releasing updates of any sort for an OS that is more than 3.
Okay, right. Yeah. But I think you're going to be okay with El Capitan on this.
Oh, yeah. All right. Yeah, that's still fairly recent.
John, listener John has a question, and I'm hoping you have more of an answer than I have for this one. He says, I'm having an issue with some apps, specifically Chrome, automatically loading every time I log in to Sierra. I verified that open at login is not selected in the launch bar. I have verified that it is not set to launch under my user profile. I have checked the old launch locations, library launch agents, home library launch agents. I even purchased a copy of Lingon X and removed everything that had Google in it. Chrome still launches every single time I log in. What is even odder is that I have a couple of apps that I have specifically marked to autoload at login via my user profile that do not load. I've tried everything I could find via Google searches and nothing has helped. Have you guys seen this behavior before, and or do you have any suggestions not only to get rid of Chrome launching, but actually get the other apps to auto launch? So I have a similar problem. I can get things to launch that I put in launch login items or you know, launch agents or any of that. But I have a couple of things. There's a thing, it's called Desk App. It's a client for WhatsApp that I no longer want to launch on my Mac, and yet it launches every time. And I think TeamViewer is launching constantly on my Mac, and I can't find that either in any of these places. So, John, what are we missing? Where else can we look? Do you know?
Yes.
Oh, I am so... This was not a setup, folks. I really didn't know what answer John was... As well, always, I didn't know what answer John was going to give.
I mean, as far as I know, it's a deprecated way of starting things up at startup.
Okay.
So as far as I know... All right, so there's a few different library folders lurking about, I believe. One is at the top level of your hard drive. I think there's another in system...
Yeah.
Library, and then your user directory.
Right.
Library.
Okay. Right. Well, and he talked about that. Launch agents in two of those folders. Okay. All right.
So the thing is, as far as I know, there are not 2, but 3 places where things could be. And I think that I hope this is the magic answer. Otherwise, I'm at a loss here.
Sure.
So then there are 3 folders within the library folder that will contain things that happen on startup. One is launch agents. One is launch daemons, and another is called startup items.
Oh, startup items. Because I think Lingon will look in launch agents and launch daemons, or launch daemons.
Correct.
We're not going to have that argument right now. But yeah, I forgot about startup items. Oh, dude.
And I see that folder, and I'm almost certain that they don't want... I think if there's stuff... Now, the thing is, I looked through my various ones very quickly, and I don't have anything in any of them. I'll double-check again, because, again, they're... You know, those 3 folders, the 3 folders that may have things that run on startup, that's the 3rd one that we all kind of forgot about, because I think they really don't want you to use that.
Very cool. Oh, yeah. Okay. And in addition to Lingon, folks in the chat room are recommending something from SomaZone called Launch Control. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes, too. just to have some other options here. But yeah, I'm a Lingon person as well. So very cool. Thank you, Mr. Braun. I appreciate that. I'm going to take a look at that when we finish the show here. All right, John, you want to take us to Michael?
Yeah, you could look now because I'm going to take us to Michael.
All right.
And Michael actually contacted me directly on Twitter. And if you want to know where to reach me on Twitter, I'm John F. Braun. If you want to reach him, he's Dave Hamilton. Please keep in mind that neither of those handles represent the opinions or stated positions of either Mac Geek App or Mac Observer, which are the two other handles. And then to round it out, though, of course, there's Pilot Pete, all on Twitter.
I miss Pilot Pete. We gotta get him back here.
Piloting.
I know.
But anyways, right. So Michael had an interesting question, and I've run into this in the past. So wait, hold on. There he is. Okay, so he sent it on Twitter here. So Michael says, "Hi, John. Safari, Chrome, and Google Drive say I'm not connected to the internet on my MacBook Pro. Everything else says I am. Thoughts?" And my thought was, I would look in System Preferences, Network, Interface, whatever interface you happen to be connected, you know, could be Wi-Fi, could be Ethernet, whatever, Advanced, Proxies, and to make sure one is not set by accident. And his reply was, boom, you're a genius.
Dude, that's
thank
awesome.
Thank you, Michael.
So here's an
I've run into this before, and now you may be asking yourself, what is a proxy server? I mean, the name of it kind of implies what it does. So proxy means you're doing something on someone's behalf. And this was a technology that I think some people still deploy. It's a way to control and monitor access to a service. So if you have an HTTP or web proxy, what happens is your browser will connect to that and then connect to the internet, and then it will return the results back to you. But the problem is, if you don't actually have a proxy server set up, then it's going to say something like Michael saw, which is what? So he must have just had one of those boxes checked. And I could have been a random bit flip in the operating system or a file getting plist file getting corrupt. Who knows? But
it could also have been it's installing some other piece of software may have asked for not root permissions, but, you know, authenticated permissions, which would then allow you or allow it to make that change. Because I've seen things do that when you're installing some enterprise thing or something that requires a proxy server, because there are cases where that makes good sense. There were actually some ISPs. Maybe they still exist. Blue. What was the satellite provider that had Blue in its name? They required you to use a proxy server in order to connect. That was years ago. I mean, it can happen. So here's the interesting thing. In his note to you, he mentioned Safari, Chrome, and Google Drive. And indeed, all of those read OS X's or Mac OS's proxy settings or network settings, but specifically the proxy settings. If he had tried Firefox, it would have worked. Well, it would not have been impacted. Firefox's own proxy settings might have been corrupted or changed. But Firefox does not read the OS X proxy settings, which can be a handy thing if you have some scenario where you need to use a proxy. By doing it with Firefox, you won't impact the rest of your system. You just impact your browsing session inside Firefox. So just a little tidbit to share there.
Yeah, good stuff. They have to be a little different.
Well, because Chrome uses WebKit to do its work. Firefox does different stuff. That doesn't mean that it has to use the proxy settings, but it is just sort of the byproduct of that. So, yeah, it's good stuff. You know what I want to do, John? I want to talk about our three sponsors here, if that's okay.
Okay.
All right. So the first one that I want to start with, as I mentioned in the pre-show, is Otherworld Computing, MacSales.com, and their Thunderbolt dock. It's their Thunderbolt 3 dock. So it's available for pre-order now. We were talking about this in the last show because somebody was asking, how do I get all of my stuff plugged in to my new MacBook or MacBook Pro? of course, that has nothing but USB-C ports on the but this would only work on the MacBook Pro because not all USB-C ports are equal. The Thunderbolt 3 dock only works on things that have Thunderbolt 3 capable USB-C ports. And we'll talk about that in a minute, too, because Otherworld Computing's got a great link to explain the differences in all those ports. But I think that's coming later in Cool Stuff Found. So I might have just broken the ice on that. 13 ports on this thing. Okay. It's got an SD card reader, audio in and out, and USB 3.1 Gen 1. That's on the front. And then on the back, it's got four more USB 3.1 Gen 1 ports, an SPDIF port for digital audio, FireWire 800, Gigabit Ethernet, dual Thunderbolt 3 USB-C ports, which means one can go to your MacBook Pro, and then one can go down the chain or to whatever it is that you want. And then it's got a mini display port for displays. Does not indicate that those are for Thunderbolt 2 stuff, so you would need something else for that. And then, of course, power, because we all need power. So this is available for $279 in the pre-order. That's $20 off of the retail price of $299. You got to check it out. Go visit them at MacSales.com. Our second sponsor, VideoBlox. These folks know what they're doing. VideoBlox really makes it truly simple to go and get like stock video, B-roll video footage, whatever you want. And the coolest part is their website makes this super easy. You just put in searches. They have kind of some pre-built searches because they know the type of stuff that you'd be looking for if you're doing any kind of video production. You know, I'm making with my son, we're making a hockey highlight reel because he's applying to a different program in a different school. And so we're thinking about using, you know, like some crowd shots or whatever, and we could use them from VideoBlox. Makes it really easy. So you just go in and you type crowd shots, and now you just start seeing these things. And as you float over them in your browser, it just shows them to you. And then, of course, you can dig deeper and get more details. Everything that you get from VideoBlox, simple, unrestricted licensing, 100% royalty free, even after your subscription has come to an end. So whatever you get during the course of your subscription there, free for you to use, royalty free after the fact. So you can embed it in something. You don't have to worry about paying the subscription just to keep that stuff licensed. And here's the deal. Normally a subscription is $249. If you visit videoblocks.com/MGG, you can get a 1-year subscription for just $149, and that comes with a subscription to AudioBlox, which is very similar to VideoBlox, but with audio snippets. So you got to check this out. Visit videoblocks.com/MGG to get your VideoBlox 1-year subscription for just $149. Check it out. Our thanks to VideoBlox for sponsoring this episode. And of course, our friends at Barebones Software, barebones.com, the makers of BB Edit, one of my favorite tools. And yeah, I say this all the time. It's crazy that I am crazy about a text editor, but I use it for so much different stuff. First of all, it's great for what I call sanitizing text. You ever copy text from a web page and then paste it into an email? And it's like, barfing all this weird formatting and stuff all over the place. Paste it into BB Edit first. BB Edit only works with text. Paste it in, copy. Now the stuff that's on your clipboard is only text. You can paste it into an email. You don't have to lose all the rest of your formatting by converting to plain text. The rest of your email, because you're pasting this in as plain text, it inherits whatever formatting you have. And that's not just true of emails. That's true if you want to take something from a web page and paste it into, say, a Pages document. Once you go through BB Edit, convert it to plain text, you're good to go. You can also count the number of words that you have. In fact, it keeps a running count down in the lower left corner. It'll count the number of characters, count the number of lines. You can do multi-file searches. So if you've got a folder full of stuff, you can point a search at that folder and it'll find it. And then you can actually do multi-file find and replace. So if you've got a folder full of stuff and you need to change one thing throughout that folder, man, It's all right there. There's so many things. Anything that you would want to do with text, BBEdit lets you do it. It's so cool. It's not, and you'll notice throughout this spot, I haven't mentioned anything that would be unique to people using this only for programming. So much stuff you can do with BBEdit. You got to check it out. Go download your free trial. Visit barebones.com. Download your free trial of BBEdit. Check it out. You get it for 30 days. And then after that, it's $50. But I think that's short money for all the stuff that BBEdit can do for you. Our thanks to Barebones Software and BBEdit for sponsoring this episode. All right, John. Now, let's go to Rachel, shall we? Rachel writes... Wait a minute. Where is Rachel? There she is. I was wondering if you could help me with the last steps as I'm trying to disable iCloud from my iPhone and my MacBook. My goal is to eventually just use iCloud for my phone backup and use an external drive or something else for my MacBook. I've been reading the article that I put up. She says how to safely disable iCloud photo library and reclaim space for iCloud. But I'm stuck at the end of it because there's not enough space on my Mac to download a second copy of all my photos. I think I have all the photos on my Mac already, but I don't know. So I feel like I'd be okay skipping this step, but I want to make sure I have the full resolution photos on my Mac before I delete them from the cloud. I'm wondering if there's a way I can look through my photos and see if the full resolution version is still there in photos. I did download some photos from iCloud and check the size versus the size of the photo on my Mac, and the photos on my Mac seem to be bigger than the same photo downloaded from iCloud, 8 megs versus 5 megs. I know that there is a setting to download originals to my Mac to use before disabling iCloud, but I tried that and let it run for a couple of weeks, and it appears to still be running, but I'm not sure. Any advice? So yeah, that download originals to Mac should work, but obviously it's not. One thing I can advise is that even after you disable iCloud Photo Library, that stuff will live in the iCloud web interface available for you to download for 30 days. My advice in this scenario, especially since it sounds like there might be something corrupted, I don't even know that corrupted is the right word, but there's something weird about that particular Mac and that particular photo library, is you can do one of two things. Number one, download all the photos. Use Safari to download all the photos to a different drive, right, where you might have more room, like an external drive or something like that. And then you could import those back into photos after you've turned off iCloud Photo Library. So that'd be one way. The other way would be to take that photo library, quit Photos, take that library, copy it, move it rather to an external drive so that it's, you still have it, but it's out of the way. Create a new library with photos, which should happen automatically if you've moved that out of the way. But if it doesn't, pull down the option key, I believe, right, John, when you launch photos, and that'll let you create a new library. Create a new library, attach that to your iCloud photo library, and let it slurp all your photos and albums and everything back down into that. As long as you've got download originals to this Mac checked, now you're not trying to merge the two. Now it's just bringing down a clean copy of what's on iCloud. Once you've got that, then I'd feel really safe about turning off iCloud Photo Library. What do you think, John?
Tricky. I like it. As you know, I'm not a current user.
Right.
But oh, I remember
I
this
about that. Yeah.
But I remember the same thing is that I think I had, it was inadvertently enabled when I did the last, I think when I upgraded to iOS 9, it enabled it. And I'm like, oh man, I don't want this. So I turned it off, and the same thing. You know, the web interface would make it very clear. Hey, you got 30 days, 29, 28.
Right.
The thing is, I knew I had all the full resolution photos that I wanted. They were still on my phone.
Sure.
And in addition to be backed up via Dropbox and I think Flickr. So I'm like, yeah, I'm cool.
Yeah, right. You got them. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I have a different rant, John. And this was something that you and I saw each other on Thursday. We got together and went to a Pepcom show in New York. And while we were waiting for the doors to open to Pepcom, we were standing there with Harris Fogel. And He was talking about how he had to restore from a backup and realized that his backup had a bunch of corrupted data on it and all of that stuff. And then we started talking about how stuff can just go missing from not only your main drive, but if you are backing up a drive that now no longer has what you want, that data is gone. And I know this is all obvious, right? And with your backups, you should be verifying them occasionally to make sure that they match whatever they're backing up. But what if you delete a major folder of things from your drive without, you know, unintentionally? And then, of course, that gets backed up and then you're screwed. And that happened to me a couple of years ago. I have a folder of all the presentations I've ever done. Right. And, you know, for like trade shows and user group meetings and all that stuff, conferences, whatever it is, I just have one folder of it. And I went to make a new one 1 year. And it was probably about this time of year, fall maybe. And like the folder's gone. I went to save it in the folder. I'm like, it's gone. What's going on here? And I look and it's not there. When I look at my backup from a month before, it's not there. I look at my backup from 6 months before and it's there. So I had to pull it over and, you know, I don't think I lost anything. But I have no idea when this folder got removed. Now, I know that I probably did it. I probably was just going through doing stuff quickly in my documents and tossed it, right? You know, I highlighted the wrong thing and away it went. Nothing told me that I did this. Now, I know it's my fault, but I feel like some backup software, especially like a clone thing where I'm backing up every day. And so I'm going to make sure I send this segment to the folks that make, you know, at Bombic Software that make Carbon Copy Cloner and Dave Nanian who makes Super Duper. And I feel like there's an opportunity here for a backup vendor to, especially a clone piece that, you know, a piece of cloning software to say, hey, wait a minute. This one major folder that's been here for a long time, or, you know, the difference between yesterday's clone and today's clone was a massive number of documents. Just wanted to alert you to that. Now, sometimes that's going to happen. You know, you do an OS upgrade and there's a massive number of documents that are different. But by and large, your system shouldn't change all that much from day to day, right? I mean, we're talking about a couple of documents here and there, but especially things that have been deleted or replaced. Stuff that's been edited, okay, fine. But stuff that's been deleted or replaced, I feel like that's a pretty easy test to do, especially with, you know, again, these clones that have the option to then also have, you know, like a safety net or whatever that is. Yeah. I would like to just get a note that says, like, just, you know, I get a note that says your clone succeeded successfully or succeeded or failed. You know, I get those notes every day. I would like to get one that says, hey, just highlights lots of files went missing overnight. Just wanted to make sure you knew about that. And then that's it. You know, that's
okay. Because as you pointed out, Carbon Copy Cloner already does that. They have something called Safety Net.
Well, right. But I don't know when to use Safety Net. That's the thing. Yeah.
Well, it's kind of automatic.
No. I don't know when to worry about going in there.
I think what you want is a notification.
A notification. Yeah.
If there's a significant amount of data being put in Safety Net.
Right. Right.
And maybe some conditions around it.
There you go.
That's a good idea.
Yeah. Yeah, because I get an email every day for three different machines. Lisa's computer, the one here in the studio, the one in my office that run currently they all run Carbon Copy Cloner. And I get a note every day that tells me how long the copy took, whether it succeeded, how many files were copied. That's great. But what it doesn't tell me is how many files were deleted, like how many are you know what I mean? So that's how much was put in the safety net? That would be it. And, you know, have a threshold where if it's above a certain number, put it in red or, you know, highlight it in the email or something, you know, that kind of thing. I don't know. That's my thought.
Yeah, I'm going to have to dig into my safety net because I'm having an issue right now where one of my Parallels virtual machines is messed up.
Oh,
well, it's the Windows 7 one. The thing is, when I say update Windows components, it just kind of sits there forever and ever and ever. And they have a repair tool, and it, you know, supposedly will try to repair the Windows update facility. But it says, yeah, I fixed most of it, but there's still these parts that are screwed up. I restored from the earliest Time Machine backup I had of it, and it's still corrupt, but I think I may have it further back.
Sure.
My carbon copy cloner backup.
Sure.
Or I may just want to, I mean, you know, Windows 7. I have an XP, Windows 7, and Windows 10. I mean, I just have Windows 7 just,
yeah,
you know, to get nothing, some hands-on with it.
Nothing wrong with that, yeah.
Though 10 is the latest, maybe I should just abandon it.
10 is,
and I have the XP one just because.
Yeah, right. Right. No, I get it. I get it. All right. Okay, so back to photos and phones. We've got Robbie here with yet another similar question. He says, I ran into an odd issue with my iPhone 6S where it would shut down whenever the battery was set at or below 28%. A visit at the Genius Bar did not solve my problem. The Genius suggested I delete all my settings as a first step, and if that did not work, to completely erase the phone and not sync it back or restore from a backup. After backing up my iPhone to iTunes and, for the first time, my Photos to the Photos app in OS X or Mac OS, I took the plunge and reset the phone. My issue now relates to my photos. I was able to use iTunes to sync my newly blank iPhone with the Photos library on my computer. However, almost all pictures that were imported to the phone now show up in the Places folder within Photos and not in my camera roll. This does not allow me to view my pictures in chronological order. Where the pictures were taken is irrelevant to me. How can I get all my photos into one folder, even if it's not the camera roll, that shows them in chronological order without having to restore my phone to a backup I created in a prior version? Would iCloud Sync solve this issue? So, yeah, iCloud Photo Library would definitely solve this issue because now you have the one photo library that sort of rules them all. The camera roll is just that. Things that particular camera knows that it has taken. And so by wiping the phone and restoring the pictures back, effectively the phone has decided, yeah, that those weren't taken in this version of this phone. So you're not going to see them in your camera roll, but you should be able to see them in the all photos setting. If you go into Photos, Albums, All Photos, you should be able to see that on your device. Now, John, I am running iCloud Photo Library, so I might be giving bad advice here. Do you see Photos, Albums, All Photos on your iPhone? Can you check that for us? I'm pretty sure that's where that's going to appear.
The case. If I go to, yeah, it's kind of roundabout. So I go to camera.
No. Go to photos. Don't go to camera. Photos.
No. And then I go to all photos, albums.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Photos, albums, all photos. Yeah. Albums being the little tab in the lower right of your photos app. So you do have an all photos album here, despite not running iCloud Photo Library, correct?
Yes.
All right. So that should work for you, Robbie. I hope it does. Anyway. So there we go. All right. Anything else to add on this before we move on to Michael?
No, I think. iMazing does some photo management too.
iMazing, yeah, it can put stuff back on, but that's where it's going to put it, is in the all photos thing. Although you probably, I haven't tried iMazing to repopulate the camera roll, but I feel like maybe that would work. All right, we'll test that. In the meanwhile, we'll jump to Michael here. Michael asks, it's driving me crazy. While I'm at my desk, I like to listen to iTunes. I have a JBL speaker that is Bluetooth capable, and also directly plugged in via a physical audio cable to the headphone port on my mid-2012 MacBook Pro. I'm running the latest versions of Sierra and iTunes. In Sound Preferences, System Preferences Sound, I have the headphones port chosen as the output, so I assume this means I have a direct connection to the speaker so that Bluetooth would not matter. It seems like I'm getting Bluetooth interference, though, and that's assuming there is such a thing as Bluetooth interference. Periodically, on a somewhat random basis, the sound will drop out completely. If I go to the sound preferences and toggle between Bluetooth and the headphone port, no change. Pause and play song in iTunes, no change. The weird part is that if I try to get a system sound out to the speaker, it works fine at this point. Eventually, after 30 seconds or so, the sound comes back from iTunes and it plays as expected for a time and then cuts out again. I've removed the speaker from being connected via Bluetooth with no change. I have tried several other speakers with the same behavior happening. I've switched out the cord between the speaker and the headphone jack. I have tried to only connect via Bluetooth with no change. I do not have Growl or any other notification software interrupting iTunes. Any idea what's going on? So, yeah. So Bluetooth interference is definitely a real thing. And there's lots of things that can interfere with it. It runs at the 2.4 megahertz range.
Gigahertz.
Sorry. As soon as I said it, I knew that you were going to correct me. But thank you. 2.4 gigahertz range. Yeah, 2.4 megahertz would be different. And so Wi-Fi can get in the way, you know, cordless phones, if you still use those, microwave ovens, you know, all that stuff. USB hard drives. No, that's only 5 gigahertz that gets in the way of, right? Yeah, USB 3 drives. But anyway, yes, it is a very real thing. In fact, you know, large vessels of water, i.e. human bodies, can cause Bluetooth problems too. If you've got, you know, your phone in your left pocket and your Bluetooth headset on your right ear, sometimes even that won't work or will get staticky or cut out because you're in the way. So Bluetooth interference is real. Have you, and I'm fairly convinced that that speaker, that iTunes is talking to that speaker via Bluetooth. Have you tried turning Bluetooth off entirely on your Mac? If you go into System Preferences, Bluetooth, and just turn it off. I realize this might not be possible even for a test if you're keyboard or mouse or any of those devices are also Bluetooth, that doesn't work so well. But that would be one thing to test to see if that solves the problem. And it's because it does sound like iTunes is choosing to stream over Bluetooth, regardless of the fact that it's also, that speaker is also plugged into your headphone port. iTunes is a little bit different for Bluetooth stuff. Bluetooth and AirPlay devices show up in iTunes just to the left of what I'll call the iTunes sort of title bar. So in the center of the top of your iTunes window is, if you're not doing anything, an Apple logo, but otherwise it's showing you the status either of the song that's playing or the files that are downloading or the movie that's being synced or whatever, you know, whatever it is that iTunes is doing, it shows you in the middle. Just to the left of that, there's a little, I don't even know what to call this icon, but it's a little triangle at the bottom with emanating circles from the top. And that's where you choose what device or devices are going to be playing your music or your audio from iTunes. And you can choose a Bluetooth speaker here or an AirPlay speaker here without it impacting the rest of your system settings. So it sounds like iTunes is choosing your Bluetooth speaker here. Go up, choose built-in headphones here and see if that solves your problem. That's my advice on this one. Otherwise, I really don't know what to do, but hopefully that does it. Any thoughts on this one, John, before we move on?
I wonder what that icon is called. Yeah, the triangle with the circles.
It's the triangle with the circles. Yeah, that's what I'm calling it. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what that's called.
If you hover... Oh, yeah, usually if you hover over something, you get a tool.
Some sort of description. Yeah, exactly.
Well, it says choose which speakers to use.
Right.
In my case, it says computer, Apple TV, and JB AirPlay.
Right.
Those are all Wi-Fi.
Yeah, they're AirPlay devices.
I don't have any. Yeah. Okay. So if you have Bluetooth speakers, they'll show up there as well. Okay.
Yeah.
That's good to
know. Yeah.
I don't have any yet.
Right. Or not paired to that Mac. Yep. All right. Andrew. Let's talk a bit about Andrew here. He asks, where are we here? Is optimized storage on macOS Sierra off by default or not? I investigated this feature and found that some selections are checked by default. However, I am not sure if it is actually running. I think there should be a clear off and on button so that you can make selections as to when optimized storage is running. And yeah, it's true. So if you go to About This Mac, and this is only in Sierra, well, at the moment, I don't know when you're going to be listening to the show. If it's 10 years from now, well, that's different. But at the moment, only in Sierra, About This Mac, Storage, Manage, or if you go to System Information, if you launch that app, go to the Window menu and choose Storage Management. There is a screen that shows several things. Store in iCloud, Optimize Storage, Empty Trash Automatically, and Reduce Clutter. And with Optimize Storage, there is the Optimize ... button that can bring up some of this stuff, but you can also go to iCloud Drive options where you can see whether or not you have desktop and documents folders synced. Photos option shows you whether or not you have iCloud Photo enabled. And that's what what a lot of this stuff is. It gets very, very strange. This storage management menu is really just sort of a top level interface that turns on a bunch of options, or that gives you the ability to turn on a bunch of options that in order to then disable, you need to go into their specific places. And that's why you can still go to iCloud and turn on iCloud Drive and then specifically choose what you're syncing to iCloud Drive with options. Again, with photos, the same sort of thing. So yeah, it's a little confusing. And even getting to this window is a little confusing because there's two ways to get there and none of them are obvious. What do you think about this, John?
Yeah, I agree with you. Because yeah. I did choose the... So because I now have the 50 gig iCloud.
Right.
I decided, hey, let me do this iCloud Drive thing. So yeah, as you say, you click on iCloud Drive and then options. And there's a checkbox for desktop and documents.
Right.
And I clicked on it, and it did something kind of unexpected. It did it reshuffled things on my computer. And then it created a folder called Documents.
Sure.
Dash MacBook Pro. And I'm like, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Crazy stuff. But it's also up in the cloud, which, yeah. So the thing is, I had to actually create a new shortcut in my sidebar because the old one kind of changed its nature.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
The documents folder, I mean, it's, is it still? No, it did move it.
Yeah. 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 It's nuts. So yeah, manage all that stuff. Feel free to turn it on here. See the advice is sort of a, I'm not even sure that that's the right word, but feel free to turn it on here, but then go and manage it in the other places. All right, John, it's time to do some cool stuff found here. Because that's what we do sometimes. Patrick says, where's my cursor here? Oh, I see your cursor. Patrick writes, did you know that Amazon Cloud allows upload of folders if you're using it in Chrome? Every other browser will only let you upload files. And I did not know that. So thank you, Patrick. Patrick's from MacOvation. So if you are in the Louisiana, Shreveport, Louisiana area, check out MacOvation. Thank you for that tip, Patrick. That's awesome. Great, great stuff. I love little tips like that. And it's just, yeah, some things, I mean, every browser, you know, they all support sort of a basic feature set, but you can write things specifically for different browsers. And Chrome seems to get a lot of kind of the obviously non-Apple stuff. There are things that Safari is the only browser to work for it, like streaming an Apple live event can only work in Safari. At least I've never been able to make it work in another browser. Have you, John?
I haven't tried it.
All right. As mentioned earlier, James suggests that we all should go read this great infographic that Otherworld Computing has made at their blog.maxsales.com site, but we'll put it in the show notes. And of course, here in the chapters and timestamps for you, beautiful infographic showing all the cables that look exactly the same and do different things. So very, very cool. Thank you so much to you, James, for sharing this. And then also to Otherworld Computing for creating it. So very good stuff. Did you check that out, that infographic, John?
No.
No. All right. Well,
I don't need to yet.
That's right.
I'm a bit behind the curve there. I don't have any USB-C devices.
The only USB-C device I have, I believe, is my Apple TV 4. And that only, I only need to use USB-C with that if I'm uploading like a beta version to it or need to do any diagnostics or grab screenshots that, you know, here's a tip for you. If you have an Apple TV 4 and you want to grab screenshots direct from the TV, plug in a USB-C to USB-A cable into your Mac, right? So I bought a cheap one from Amazon or something, but plug that cable in, then run QuickTime, the QuickTime player, and where's the option? QuickTime player, if you go to new screen recording, you can choose what screen you want to record from, and boom, there is your Apple TV in a window. So you can take screenshots of that window, and now you've got screenshots from your Apple TV. You can do that from your iPhone too. If you do the same thing, if you plug your iPhone in, you know, obviously Lightning or 30 pin, if you've got an older iPhone, plug it in and you're good to go. So there's a little tip. Les from, I believe, Les writes, he said, Walmart carries a great line of products called Black Web. I bought one of their MFI certified lightning to USB cables, and I recommend you guys all take a look. I've bought non-MFI cables that look good, but the connector bends easily and comes apart into pieces very quickly. Walmart's Black Web connector is a one piece, and the collar is small, allowing charging and syncing on an iPad Pro even while it's still in its case. These cables are 4 feet long instead of 3 feet or 1 meter, and it's flat, so it won't tangle. The price is $10, which is a little more than you pay for a non-MFI cable at a gas station and a lot less than a shorter cable from Apple. Like you guys, I'm both big fans. I am a big fan of Anchor products, but this looks like a less expensive alternative to their Lightning cable. Cool. Thanks, Les. Very, very cool stuff. Walmart. There you go. Maybe Black Friday, you can go to Walmart and fight the crowds for Black Web Lightning cables.
No.
You could. You know, we've made a family tradition of going to, like, our mall here opens late on Thanksgiving night. So after we've had, you know, dinner and dessert and we're all like sugared up and can't sleep yet and all of that, we go to the mall late, and it's actually kind of fun. It's not overly packed. I mean, there's people there for sure, but it's not like mayhem, and it's sort of the pre-Black Friday sale. So I don't know. It's just become kind of a fun thing to go and check out. And we come home and we sleep in. You want to take us to your?
I'm going
to
take you somewhere, Dave.
Great.
All right. So I'm always seeking the truth.
Right.
Now, some may argue that the truth is absolute. Some may say that the truth is relative. You will never know an absolute truth. Now we're going to get into philosophy.
I would say, how can anybody be enlightened? The truth is, after all, so poorly lit.
Okay.
Okay.
I don't know where that's from. No. But, well, there's a tool that I used, and I used it for a couple of applications as of late. And I'll try to make this as quick as possible. So one was a LinkedIn invite that I got. You know, so-and-so would like to connect with you on LinkedIn.
Sure.
You know, so I clicked on their invite link, and I saw that they already were linked to a couple of people that I work with in a past corporate life. But their profile picture just seemed kind of off in that it was like a glamour shot. Like a model. And I was like, you know, that's not right. And I looked at their background. It was kind of generic. And the thing is, I didn't know this person as far as I know. So I'm like, you know what? Let me take the photo. And so you can do this in pretty much any browser. So I right-clicked on the photo, said save image. And where I went, Dave, was TinEye.com. What is TinEye, you ask? Well, TinEye is a reverse image search, which as of this moment has 16.5 billion images. Indexed and growing. That's
cool.
What they claim. Sure. So I pasted the image in there and it did its search. And as it turns out, this picture was of Miss Teen New York City in 1990 something. And I'm like, all right. So either it was a bogus LinkedIn account and I reported it as such, or this person liked to use a glamour shot that wasn't them for their profile, which don't do that.
Right. Wait, I'm not supposed to use her picture as my avatar on Twitter, John?
Yeah, I just don't get it. So either, even if the person was a fan, you know, don't use someone else's picture for your avatar. That's just a bad idea. And eventually it looks like they deactivate the account. I wasn't sure of the motivation. Another one, it came up where I saw, you know, someone had posted a picture and they were like, well, this is a supporter of candidate A, and they're doing something unspeakable to a poster of candidate B, and this shows why these people are horrible, blah, blah, blah. And it was retweeted by someone who I will consider not a journalist, but a entertainer.
Okay.
Because journalists are supposed to fact check. And so I took the picture, and I'm like, you know, let me see if it really is, you know, what this person said it was.
Sure.
And I pasted it into TinEye. There's another engine I'll tell you about in a moment. But I pasted it in, Dave. And as it turns out, no, it wasn't something from the current campaign. It was actually a photo that was taken in of an event that occurred in 2012 in the country of Mexico.
Ah.
So, and I kind of got back to the person. I'm like, yeah, nice try.
Right. Yeah.
You know, again, you know, check your
facts. Spread the truth. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Now, there's another one. So Tanai is the one, my go-to. Another one is if you go to image.google.com, they offer very similar functionality as well, in that you can either paste in a link for an image or just upload the image, and it'll tell you, here's the other places that I found it.
Right.
So between those two, if you want to find out the source of an image, they're almost certainly going to find it. If it's from the past,
so you know, right,
it's a fresh one, they won't.
So with Google Image Search at that page, you have to choose the little camera icon to search by image. Otherwise, you will just be searching for images that match your search terms. But if you hit the little camera, then you get the option to either paste a URL to an image and we'll find you other instances of that one. Or, as John said, you can upload an image there. So, yeah, very, very cool stuff. Yeah, Google Image Search. I'd never heard of Tanai until you mentioned it the other day. But Google Image Search I use all the time to kind of, you know, find stuff.
And it's just so much fun. I mean, I feel like a detective. And actually, right. I am being a detective.
Yeah.
Like, where did this image come from?
Yeah.
Well, it was really cool stuff. And I see Tanai. I don't know if Google has this, but Tanai, I notice here, they actually have browser plugins for Firefox, Chrome, Safari, and Opera. So you can quickly, so you don't even have to go to their webpage. I guess you could just install the plugin and do your thing.
Cool. All right. Bruce writes in and says, Apple's procedure for repairing user permissions as opposed to system permissions has been the same since introducing the recovery partition, which is to boot from there, run terminal, and then type in reset password, all one word, which would then open that utility. This behavior has changed in Sierra with a new version of that utility. The UI is much more friendly, but Apple has removed some functionality, including the ability to change the root password, and repairing user permissions is no longer an option. Sigh. For that, I now return to Yasu for Mac, or yet another system utility for Mac, which is at yasuformac.com. Well, here's the thing. So this is a cool stuff found revisited, because we've talked about Yasu before, but it's come and gone. The development of it, you know, at times has not been up to speed with whatever the current OS is. And then sometimes it is. Now it is here again for us. And yeah, I love Yasu. It's so simple. And yet lets you do so many cool things, and resetting your home folder permissions, which is very different from resetting system permissions, which really you can do in Sierra and El Capitan, but it's kind of not really there. But it also lets you run some of your system scripts and clear out caches and remove logs and those sorts of things. But the resetting of home folder permissions, very, very handy and very, very helpful at times. Whatever system integrity protection does to make sure you don't need to reset your system permissions does not mean that your home folder permissions will remain the way you want them or the way you should have them. And Yasu can help do that. So thank you, Bruce, for bringing this back to our attention. I love that kind of stuff. And then, John, moving on to Joel, who had a great tip of cool stuff found actually in the post show. So he was, Joel is often a listener in our chat room here at MacGeekGab.com/stream. And Joel recommended Sonic Pi at sonic-pi.net, the live coding music synth for everyone. And you can learn to code creatively by composing or performing music in an incredible range of styles. It's very, very cool. You can download it for Raspberry Pi, which I believe is where its name came from, but it's also available for Mac. So, and compiled 64-bit and all that good stuff. And you can just go and download it. So we will put a link to that in the show notes because it's cool and you've got to check it out. So thank you very, very kindly, Joel, for hipping us to that. We like cool stuff, truly cool stuff found. A revisit, I believe, but always a good one. Palm suggests VNC from Real VNC on iOS to connect to a Mac running Apple screen sharing. He says it can be used instead of screens and it's free. So we will put a link to that in the show notes too. Thank you so much, Palm, for re-hipping us to that. We mentioned screens in the recent show and we didn't mention Real VNC. So Thank you for that reminder.
My only concern with VNC is that you may want to be careful because I believe the VNC protocol.
Well, that's what he's saying. It's not using, I mean, it is, but it's connecting to the very same screen sharing in iOS, Real VNC, in macOS, Real VNC for iOS right. will connect to
well,
that.
You didn't let me finish. Is Go that ahead. I believe the VNC protocol of its own, I don't think is terribly secure.
Right.
So if you are going to use VNC to connect to something, you may want to make sure you have a VPN or some other security layer.
Right.
Because I think someone could potentially look at the VNC traffic and find out all your secrets.
Yeah. In fact, that's what happened. What was it? 3 or 4 shows ago, we had that listener whose Mac had been totally hacked because he had opened up that VNC port to the outside world. So yeah, definitely using a VPN would be a huge, huge thing there for sure. Yeah. Cool stuff. You're right, John. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Where else?
All right. We get from, we talked about our chat room, didn't we?
Which we did. I did. Yeah.
But they said SSH tunnel for those that are, it's getting kind of geeky. That is something maybe not everyone knows what that is, but an SSH tunnel is also another secure way to connect your computer.
Yeah. Yeah. An SSH. Yeah. We can put a link in the show notes to how you might set that up. If your ISP allows SSH in. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I don't like anything that exposes my Mac directly, though. And you'd probably need to expose your Mac directly for an SSH tunnel. So, but
yeah,
I don't know. That's sort of my thing. VPN, much better. But not every router supports it. We'll talk. Actually, we'll kind of have an addendum about VPNs if we can fit it into the router episode next week. I think there's actually a lot of addendums, switches and VPNs and all sorts of very related things. So. Robin writes, where is Robin? I had it, and then I lost it, John. These cool stuff found things go quickly. The Huawei MateDock USB-C multiport adapter. Robin says this is the device that anyone who is panicking about the lack of ports on the new MacBook Pro needs to have because it's available now. Spotted it on Amazon, and it arrived this morning. I do have a 2015 MacBook, so I hooked it up. The device itself is quite small, but it does what the fancy leather case does what it does. Hang on, it's very sort of chopped up review here of this thing. We'll put a link to it on Amazon. $89, and it's USB-C cable connected to this thing. It's got 2 USB 3 ports and an Ethernet port, and a VGA port and an HDMI port. So not everything, but can get you some stuff with your USB. Again, this is USB-C, not Thunderbolt. So it would work on the new MacBook Pros or the MacBooks with USB. And so it's like a mini portable dock is essentially what it becomes, I think. So the Huawei, I think I'm pronouncing that right. Where is it here? I think that's right. Yeah. Yeah. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes. But very good. Thank you very much, Robin. So for $89, you can get your portable docking needs set up there. So very cool. It's a brave new USB-C world that we're living in, Mr. Braun.
I'm living in the past.
I know, same. But but eventually we'll all be there. I think it's good. It's just, you know, change is always hard, right? That's sort of the issue. Is
change is not always good. Sometimes change is terrible. Those people that say change is good, no, it's stressful and freaks people out.
Yeah, but it's important. It's the only thing we can count on, John. We've got some time here, I believe, for a couple of tips. In fact, I know we have some time for a couple of tips. You want to take us to Giles?
I got a quickie. I got this again out of Twitter, Dave. Twitter's just amazing.
It is.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's aggravating. But it was from Giles, and it was actually in a response to, I think we were talking about getting a certain piece of Apple equipment repaired.
Sure.
And he came back and he said, to get this certain device, and he's from across the pond.
Okay.
But he said, yeah, it costs this many pounds to get this sort of repair done for this Apple device. And I'm like, well, how'd you know that? And well, he linked to an article. Now, I always thought the flat rate pricing was kind of a, you know, people talked about in hush whispers, you know, in the back room of the Apple stores and stuff, and they would never advertise this fact. Well, I was wrong, because they do. I don't know if they've always done this. I don't think they have, Dave, but I didn't see a date on the article. But the thing is, so if you search, so I did a sample here. So if you Google iPad service pricing, it comes up with an article. In this case, it's support.apple.com/iPad/repair/service/pricing. And that's where it is. And similar will come up for other Apple devices. I think I did it for iPhone, and I'm sure it'll work for others. But they tell you, okay, to get the screen fixed, it'll cost this much. To get the battery replaced, it'll cost this much. And for the flat rate repair, or out of warranty repair is what they call it, it costs this much.
Yeah, so the one for Macs is limited to only battery pricing is all that you see online. So there's a page for Mac notebooks, and it lists everything from the 11-inch Air up to the, you know, 15-inch MacBook Pro with Retina display. And all it lists here is battery pricing. There's no flat rate repair for the system. So that is not published by Apple, but some of the stuff is. Yeah.
But for the iPad, it definitely is.
For the iPad, it is.
The price that I was quoted when I, you know, went a while back. It's, for my model, it's $249.
Yeah.
And there are certain conditions, you know, you can't have thrown it off of, you know, it can't be like in pieces.
Right. Yeah. And it can't have water damage either, I don't think. So,
yeah, I think it has to be in a state where they can just pop it open, replace the
It has to be in a state that it would have qualified for warranty pricing if your warranty was still in effect.
Right.
Yeah. That's really what it is. Is you're buying AppleCare once for that particular device. Essentially is, you know, a good way to look at it. So if AppleCare would have kicked in, then right, there is this flat rate, and it does exist for iMacs, and I believe it exists for iMacs. Actually, I may have misspoke on that. Maybe somebody can clarify that for iMacs, but it definitely exists for Mac laptops, even though it's not on that website. But again, it's not always, you have to be in the right sort of, you know, range for that to kick in. Yeah, I don't know that it exists on IMAX. I may have misspoke on that. So, yeah. All right, good stuff. Moving on, more tips. In fact, one from an Apple genius that we will leave nameless, who writes a few thoughts from recent shows. Genius bars will always support you on older equipment. Yeah, and we were talking about a 2009 MacBook Pro. Even if it is legacy or vintage or obsolete or whatever, they love a challenge, and certainly there are a couple of old timers there that used to work on them. Even if they can't open them up or order parts, they will still help you as much as they can. Regarding your discussion on iOS diagnostics, I don't think a diagnostic file is stored on the device. If the user approved it, we could execute a diagnostic run on the device remotely. It would then upload to an Apple server, where it could be pulled remotely or at any Genius Bar if the case number was known. The report was used to search for some key info regarding service. This particular genius says, regarding the new notebook product line, yes, the lineup seems fragmented now. It's intentional. This is Apple's way of rolling out and ramping up new tech, as we were just saying, and testing the market. And don't worry, they won't pull a Coke classic and go back from USB-C. No, I don't think they will. I'm trying to think if there's anything else. Yeah. So yes. Yeah, there you go. Apple will not throw all their eggs into one basket by transforming the entire product line at once. And that does make sense. Yeah. We shall see. So thank you for that comment. Good to know that you might be able to find someone at the Genius Bars who's interested and willing to work on or diagnose your old machine. Fun stuff. Patrick, helps us out here. We mentioned Tech Tool Pro in a recent show, and as soon as I told the folks at Micromat about it, they confirmed what Patrick had written. He says, I've used Tech Tool Pro since the 90s and love it, but you need to warn your listeners, they have not yet updated their software to work with Sierra. Can you light a fire under their fireplace? And yes, we can. In fact, it's already lit. They lit it themselves. And we should have Sierra support soon. My guess is, and this is my guess, not theirs, but before the end of the year, we'll have TechTool Pro supporting Sierra fully. So it will warn you upon launch, which is really fantastic that it does not support Sierra yet, which is good, because you don't want to run something that is not qualified by the vendor, especially something like utility software. You all right, John?
Yeah. No, I had Onyx do that after I had upgraded to Sierra.
Oh, yeah. Right.
I didn't upgrade Onyx, and it's like, nope.
Yep. James has an interesting scenario that we'll share. James runs POP for his mail, not IMAP. And he says, I'm using Mail Steward Pro to back up my Apple Mail. I have found that Apple Mail does not delete the mail that you tell it to delete. I don't know if it deletes any of it ever, or if it just fails to delete all of it. However, I do know that it does not delete all that it has been instructed to delete. And this, to my mind, is a security breach by Apple. I use POP, as I said. He says, not IMAP, because I don't want my mail stored on my ISP's servers nor shared with other devices. I want control of my mail. It only comes to one machine. I also deal with sensitive documents, client privilege, etc., and don't want to share with anyone else. When I delete something, I expect it to be gone. But recently, while archiving my email, I noticed some item in the progress window, which I know I had previously deleted, and it was showing up as being archived. So first, I searched within Apple Mail for the items, and I didn't find them. I then searched the Mail Steward Pro database and found the items along with the file path to the item in Apple Mail. Following that path, I came to the .emix file, which actually I believe it's EMLX, but no matter, which then opened up with a text editor was in fact the message that I had deleted. Not cool. So just as a heads up to those listeners who are security conscious, the files stored in the mail database are not indexed by Spotlight once they're marked as deleted, are not searchable by Find Any File, but they are still there, at least for a while. Mail Steward Pro reads everything and archives the files, making them searchable within its MySQL database. So yeah, there might be some purging that happens, or expunging, I should say, operation that happens after the deletion happens, right? So while you're going through and triaging your mail and moving things around, you hit delete. It marks it as deleted, obviously removes it from all your searches and all that, but it doesn't necessarily at that point in time go through and take that file and throw it away. And this is not uncommon from an efficiency standpoint when you're coding something. Do the minimum necessary at the moment and then have a background task that hopefully fires up and goes through and actually processes, you know, the kind of the moving files and all of that stuff from the deletion, maybe right away, but also maybe when the system is idle or whatever down the road. Sounds like from what James is saying, this might never be happening, especially for mail that's stored as POP, so just stored locally only. So thank you for that, James. So I guess Mail Steward Pro or hunting around in mail's file database, which is sort of a mess, would be the only way to find those. So interesting stuff, John. Thoughts on this? Yes. All right. Well,
I'll buy it. I mean, I'm just looking now.
I totally believe it. Yeah.
I mean, I'm wondering if, you know, something is set different in.
I look
mail client somewhere.
There's no setting for, you know, when that expunge operation happens. So I don't know.
There is. I mean, if you go into mail and you click on the account and you go to mailbox behaviors, it'll say.
For IMAP, it'll say this.
Oh, but it doesn't for POP. Okay.
Right. But this is not. This is that for IMAP is deleting from the server, not locally. So that's sort of the interesting thing. I mean, it happens in both places, right? Because it's a client server relationship. So it will delete.
It should. Yeah. Cause I mean, the stuff is stored locally as far as I know. I mean,
right.
You look,
but you know, what he's saying is he's emptied the trash in mail and mm-hmm. it's, you know, the message is not there in his trash anymore. And yet the file still exists on his drive. That's sort of the disappointing part for James.
Yeah, I seem to recall there being a setting somewhere. Was it with Spotlight where you could say, yeah, don't, you know, don't.
Yeah.
Try not to find, you know, certain things.
Well, and that, it, but it's not, right? It's, I mean, Spotlight's being marked not to look at this file. But it's Mail Steward that, you know, just goes and slurps everything. So, yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, yeah. All right. Michael says, I just wanted to let you know that I got 16 gigs of RAM recently for my mid-2012 MacBook Pro. It's like a new machine. Who needs a Touch Bar MacBook Pro for millions of dollars? My machine is screaming now. I know that John has the same one. Michael says, I had 8 for a little while and then bought another 8 from OWC, or actually probably bought 16 and replaced the 8. He says, I love this machine and I highly recommend it to anyone looking for a great bargain that runs Sierra like a champ, has 4 cores, and is more than capable. Add a 1 terabyte SSD like I did, and your computing needs are met for years to come. Thank you, John, for the suggestion of this Mac. And thank you, Michael, for the note that the bump from 8 to 16 made a big difference for you. That's this kind of sort of experiential evidence. And you know, it's hard to take confirmation bias out of it, but in cases where you really truly can, yeah, please send in these notes and let us know whether you do or don't notice a difference. When was it, over the summer, that I upgraded my 2 El Capitan iMacs, the 27 inch from 2011 and the Retina from 2014. Crucial. I was talking with Crucial and they said, oh, you're only on 16 on those. You should be at 32. So they just sent me RAM, right? I didn't buy it. I wasn't even really digging around asking for it. I didn't think I needed it. But they sent it to me, so I put it in. Actually, it sat here for like a week before I put it in. And it was amazing, the difference. I didn't expect a difference going from 16 to 32. Because 16 is a lot. And I don't do things that are just like RAM hungry, except that it turns out I do. I run Safari and iTunes, and I have a media library of photos and stuff on my Mac. And evidently, Sierra's, I mean, I'm using less swap. It's insane that with 32 gigs of RAM on a computer and not doing, you know, like video editing or anything, that my computer ever pages into swap. But it's still, even with 32 gigs, it's not rare that I'll have, you know, 5-6 gigs of swap used. And it's almost always because Safari is just like hogging up everything. I've seen it where, you know, I get to my desk and Safari's got like, you know, 10 gigs of RAM used or 12 gigs of RAM used. It's like, dude, no. Stop it. It's crazy. I started using Marco Arment's Quitter. You know about that app, John? It's free. And you can have it quit apps after the app itself has been dormant for a period of time you specify. So with Safari, I have it quit after 2 hours. We mentioned it in a Cool Stuff Found a while back. But basically that means that Safari will stay running while I'm at my desk all day, but overnight it will quit Safari. So every day I'm starting with a fresh, you know, launch of Safari, which helps with RAM usage. But still, by the end of the day, like, it's not rare that I wind up quitting Safari midday. Google Docs is the big offender. And iCloud documents would do the same thing. But any of these kind of, you know, edit inside the browser just starts gobbling up, like instantly gobbles up, you know, half a gig. It's insane. But that's how it goes. I don't know.
Yep. You can still get that machine, Dave. I just found a place that has it.
Not from the Apple Refurb store, right?
I don't know if we're ever going to see it from the Apple Refurb store.
Right.
But I just did a quick search. And Gazelle actually still has the MacBook Pro 15-inch mid-2012, which is the machine we're talking about here.
Yeah.
For only $1,000.
No kidding.
It's not a bad price, though. I don't think if you get it from them, then I don't think you get
Right. You don't qualify for Apple Care. Right. Right.
And they say,
oh, give us a link to that, John. We'll put that in the show notes too. Very, very cool, man.
Yeah, it's still for 2012, it's still a usable machine.
It's totally
quite usable.
Yeah, absolutely. It's time to bring the band in, John. I got nothing else to say. And also, our time here is done. Don't you think?
Yeah, our time here is done. So What do we have to say? I don't think we need to tell people how to send us an email because we already told people.
Well, we said it once. I said feedback at mattgeekgab.com.
Oh, okay. Well, then I just got to make sure not to say it more than one more time. Feedback at mattgeekgab.com.
That's correct.
I
want to point out premium at mattgeekgab.com is available for all of you who use or who support us directly with our premium offering. We have now moved to a new system for processing new premium subscriptions. The existing ones that are on renewal and all of that are currently still happening with the old system. Those will be migrated over, but we've moved the anything new is happening through the new system. So it all happens through MacGeekGab.com, but that will redirect you now to MacObserver.com/shop, which is using an engine that's inside of WordPress now, as opposed to the old one, which was in our old Expression engine. And it's using a thing called WooCommerce, which actually has worked fairly well so far. So if you would like to support us directly and be one of the first to use the new system, and help us test it. I'm not really worried about testing it. We've actually done quite a bit of testing because this is important stuff and sensitive data and all that. So we didn't want to. It's why it took us so long to roll it out. We did so much internal testing. But please do, if you have any interest in supporting us directly, we would very much appreciate it. In fact, folks in this episode that are existing premium supporters, Bruce, the very first question that was asked, Giles, Robbie, Michael, Andrew, Robin, James, and Michael, and also Bruce in the middle, and I don't know if that's the same Bruce or two Bruces, so I will thank you twice, Bruce, if that's the case. Thank you all very, very kindly for your direct support, and thanks everyone for your direct support. Very, very humbling and inspiring. It is part of the thing that kind of keeps us doing what we do, and as a thank you gesture, we answer the questions that come into premium at MacGeekGab.com first. So anybody can call us at 224-888-GEEK, John, which is
4335.
Indeed. I want to thank the folks at Cashfly, CACHEFLY.com, for providing all the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. And then, of course, our great sponsors in the podcast marketplace, starts with Otherworld Computing at MacSales.com, Barebones Software at Barebones.com, VideoBlocks at VideoBlocks.com/MGG, Gazelle is a sponsor, Gazelle.com, FatCatSoftware.com/MGG, SmileSoftware.com/Geek, and Casper at Casper.com/MGG. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for sending in all your great questions and your great cool stuff found and your great tips. You all rock. If you are in the U.S. and celebrating Thanksgiving this week, happy Thanksgiving. Otherwise, to those of you that aren't, have a wonderful Thursday. And we'll see you next Sunday for our router deep dive. We'll talk a lot about mesh stuff in there, but a couple of other things too. Don't get caught.
Made up.